hello. It's Jacob Hill with GRC Academy. Today, I'm here with Mr. Aaron Lange. Aaron, how are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much for coming on. And folks, if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to like, comment, share, subscribe, review, all the things. It really helps me out. Thank you so much in advance. Aaron, can you tell us about yourself and how you got to where you are today?
My name is Aaron Lange. I'm based in southern Germany. My academic background is actually industrial engineering. So back in the days, I was thinking about becoming a real engineer, working with machines, with steels and all that stuff. And after college and my first job, I signed up in a data center as a quality manager. And very soon I found out that in a data center, quality management, information security and data privacy are very closely related. And so this is when I got into the information security space, basically. In my first job, I was part of the integrated management system. So I was running a quality management system that was combined with an ISO 27001 information security management system. And that's what really started things off for me. That's where I found this passion for security, cybersecurity, and all these things. And fast forward a couple of years, I'm working now for the largest professional service provider in the world. Also in an internal role where I serve as a security officer and I'm part of the security management system. I'm part of internal and external audits. And this is really where I found my passion. Besides working in security, I was chasing hoop dreams for quite some time during college. And yeah, when COVID hit, I decided to stop chasing these dreams, but I haven't given up my passion for teaching and mentoring. And so I began posting content on LinkedIn, helping folks out in the cybersecurity space. And I guess this is what led up to this day. And now here we are. And yeah, I'm excited to talk to you, share some insights.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That's really awesome. And I can tell you that I took your ISO 27001 course to help us out whenever we were going through our 27001 effort internally at my day job. So thank you for that. I looked at some lectures that I really needed help on, and it was really good. So thank you for that. Do you have other courses beyond the ISO 27001 course, right?
Yeah, I have a course on business process management for the BPMN standard. So if you need to model process flows, then I got you covered with that. And I'm also offering a couple of practice exams for the most common ISACA certifications. And I'm currently working on a course for the CISM exam by ISACA, but that's still in the making. So it might take a couple of months until that's done.
Yeah, I know. It takes a long time to do this, especially when it's the evenings and after work and weekends and all that. So I totally get that. But that's great. That's great. Great job doing that. Let's talk about ISO 27001. Can you talk to us about the history of the standard?
So now, first of all, this dates back a long time, way before I was involved in the industry. But originally, ISO 27001 originates in a British standard. And this British standard was very successful and it enjoyed a great recognition by industry professionals worldwide. And this is when the ISO, the International Organization for Standardization, came into play. They decided, so this standard is so good, let's make it an international standard. And so they transformed it into the ISO 17799. And this standard was basically the same as the previous British standard, but it was an international standard. And this allowed it to be adopted worldwide. Now, the beginning of this millennium, and I think it was in 2004 or five, the whole information security standards, which actually received a big makeover. And so the 17799 standard was transformed into the ISO 27001 standard. So they came up with this new family of standards, the ISO 27000 family of standards, which, by the way, contains around 150 information security related standards, not just ISO 27001 and 2, which are most of the time the only two standards people know about. There are a lot of hidden treasures actually within this family of standards that I can highly recommend. So feel free to reach out to me afterwards. Everybody is listening to that. There's some gold nuggets that I can share with you. And yeah, from then on, the standard was continually evolved and it was further enhanced. It received a big makeover in 2013 and most recently last year with the new 2022 revision.
Okay, that's very interesting. Now, whenever I look at ISO 27001, I always see the ISO/IEC. What does the IEC mean?
The IEC is the International Electrotechnical Commission. No, just like the ISO, the International Standardization Organization, or the International Organization for Standardization, they're two like non-government organizations. They reside in Switzerland, as most of these overarching bodies do. Like in soccer, for example, it's the FIFA. They reside in Switzerland. The World Economic Forum is always meeting in Davos. And so they're always kind of related to Switzerland. And this organization has around, I would say, 160, 180 member entities that are spread out worldwide. And they bring these international standards to national bodies.
How does ISO 27001 influence other frameworks or standards, like standards from NIST, CIS, and others?
That's a great question, actually. So if you study these frameworks, no matter if they're from ISO or NIST or the CIS or PCI or whatever, as you just mentioned, there are a couple of informative references where these standards relate to each other, providing further guidance or referring to other standards to take a building block and implement it into the other. Now, specifically for ISO 27001 and 2, we just heard that they have received a big makeover in 2022. Without going into too much detail for now, but in the Annex A section, ISO 27001 provides a set of reference controls. Now, and in the ISO 27002 standard, for each of these reference controls, there's an attribute table. And the attribute table, interestingly, references to the NIST cybersecurity framework. So they have what they call cybersecurity concepts, and they are basically similar to the functions of the NIST CSF, which are like identify, protect, detect, respond, recover, and so on. And each control is mapped to one of these functions or domains, which closely relates to the NIST cybersecurity framework, which is, I think, a great way of combining both. So if you are into the NIST, you can use ISO. If you use ISO, it's easy to cross-reference the NIST and so on. So I think they heavily influence each other.
Okay. Yeah, that's awesome. That's interesting. And I had a conversation with Dr. Ron Ross, who is the author of NIST 853 and RMF and a few other standards from NIST. And he was talking about the relationship between ISO and NIST. And it seems that they do talk to each other, which is good. You know, always fascinated and try to learn the backstory and all of that. That's great. Can you talk about the changes in the new version of ISO 27001?
Every management system standard that is issued by ISO follows the high-level structure. So besides ISO 27001, there's maybe an ISO 9001 for quality management. There's something for energy, environmental management. And all of these standards share the same structure when it comes to the system requirements. Now, when it comes to the system requirements in the new ISO 27001, it was basically harmonized with the high-level structure as found in other management system standards. Now, there were no huge changes, but it was aligned. The wording was harmonized, and they added a clause about how changes to the management system have been conducted in a planned fashion, basically. So that's clause 6.3. But besides that, there were no huge changes. The huge changes that we can find are all related to Annex A. Let's take a step back. So Annex A is a list of reference controls. So in clauses 4 through 10, the standard describes a management system that is aligned with the Plan, Do, Check, Act cycle that helps an organization to identify risk, assess risk, and select appropriate controls to treat risk and to stay compliant within a continuous cycle, basically. Now, and to treat risk, we obviously need controls. And these controls are provided, for example, in Annex A. Now, previously, Annex A contained 14 control objectives that were further categorized into 114 controls. Now, with the new standard, the control objectives are completely gone. What we ended up with is 93 controls that are structured into four domains: the organizational controls, the people controls, physical controls, and technological controls. So for me as a practitioner for many years, if you were talking about A9, I knew you were talking about access controls. So now that's all gone. You have organizational controls, people, and people control might be related to access control and so on. So it's a little different now. But you actually have this categorization if you have a look in ISO 27002. Now, I think let's keep that aside for the moment. What's important is it used to be 114 controls and now it's just 93. That means a couple of controls emerged, they were renamed, and even some new controls were added. for example, for threat intelligence, web filtering, physical security monitoring, just to name a few. So there are some changes, but to be honest, it's not so different than before because, of course, it's security. So you still need access controls, monitoring, logging, and so on. So
got it. Got it. Thank you. What is the relationship between ISO 27001 and ISO 27002? When I was going through and preparing to get ISO 27001 certified, they also said, well, you also need this ISO 27002 document. And I think most people know what 27001 is, but 27002, what is that? Can you explain?
Yeah, that's a question I hear a lot. And it's actually quite simple. ISO 27001 is a normative standard. That means you can hire a certification body that can certify you. ISO 27002 is an example for an informative standard. That means you cannot get certified for ISO 27002. Now, what does the standard do? As I just mentioned, ISO 27001 contains a list of reference controls in Annex A. Now, the entire ISO 27001 standard is approximately 15 to 18 pages thick. So there's not a lot of content to it. But if you require further guidance for how to implement a certain control, this is where ISO 27002 comes into place. So this standard provides further guidance on how to implement controls, and it's a couple of hundred pages thick. So if you don't know how to get started, this standard has got you covered.
Could an organization then just go to ISO 27001? Would they need the ISO 27002? I suppose they would have to be experts on 27001 and understand the security controls already. Right? Is there any case when you cannot do it without 27002?
I mean, to be honest, that's quite tricky because from what I've heard and what I've experienced is that external auditors from certification bodies, they actually base their audits and their assessments on the guidance provided in 27002. It is a good idea to follow the guidance provided to stay compliant, but to be honest, it's not necessary. If you decide to implement a control in another way that satisfies the information security objectives in terms of confidentiality, integrity, and availability, you're fine. I think it's easier to just stick to the guidelines that are, from my experience and in my opinion, they're not bad. So they are a good starting point, and even seasoned professionals can definitely learn something from them.
Can you talk about the roles involved in ISO? This is something that was very confusing to me coming from the NIST world, because I was looking at certification bodies, accreditation bodies, the role the IAF plays. Talk to us all about that.
That's also a very interesting topic that took me a while to figure out, to be honest. So let's say an organization wants to become ISO certified. No, the first thing they have to do is they have to reach out to a certification body. Now, this certification body will conduct an audit and is eligible to certify this organization. Now, why is this certification body allowed to issue certificates? This is because the certification body has to be accredited by an accreditation body. Now, where do accreditation bodies come from? Accreditation bodies exist in every country. In Germany, it's, for example, the DAX, the German accreditation company. Now, and this DAX or this accreditation body is tested and evaluated and approved by the International Accreditation Forum, which is eligible to accreditate accreditation bodies. So it's basically like a triple down pyramid where they're like controlling instances that have entities. And so it all triples down. It's like hard for me to express that in English, but I hope you get what I mean.
Yeah, sure. So IAF at the top, accreditation bodies, and then certification bodies who are actually certifying and assessing organizations.
Correct.
Awesome. Now, let me ask you this. Is it important to work with an IAF-affiliated certification body? And I understand that may not be the right terminology, but when I was doing research, we were finding a lot of ISO folks who were not affiliated with the IAF and that chain that they have. Is it important?
Yeah, that's very important because not all certificates are equal. Basically, everybody can conduct an ISO 27001 audit. I mean, an organization could hire me and I could show up and audit them and do a great job. And then later on, sign a piece of paper where I declare that everything is compliant. But this piece of paper, this certificate, is nothing worth. It's not accepted probably by suppliers or customers. Mm-hmm. So let's say you check a supplier and they provide you with a certificate. We have an ISO 27001 certificate that demonstrates our efforts towards your security. And if you provide us with your data, they're secure with us. Now, the first thing you should do is check the unique certification number. Now, with this unique certification number and the certification body provided, you can check if the certificate is really valid on the page or the website of the certification provider. Most of them have like a database where you can enter this query and you get this information very soon. Now, let's say that's the case. The next step would be to check if the certification body is actually accredited. Now, to do this, you take the name of the certification body, visit the accreditation body, and check if this body is still accredited at the time of issuing the certificate. And if that's the case, then you have a valid certificate that has to be accepted worldwide. Otherwise, you could accept it, but usually it's not.
Does the IAF have a database of accreditation bodies that they recognize?
From what I know, every country only has one accreditation body. So at least in Europe, Germany, every country has one accreditation body, and they shouldn't change. But these accreditation bodies, they have lists and databases about valid certification bodies. And these certification bodies themselves have databases of the certificates they have issued. So it can be a hassle to find that out, but the information is there.
Yeah, I think, for example, in America or North America, I think our accreditation body is ANAB. What is it for your area?
For the German area, it's DAX.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that's a really good point for folks, because especially if you're working with government, I think that validating that the certification body has that link up back up to the official accreditation bodies and then the IAF is really important, because you don't want to spend money with someone who it doesn't have that affiliation, because their certification process may not be one, it may not be compliant, but also we've all heard the horror stories about certification paper mills, you know, stuff like that. So
yeah, don't fall for that trap. I also had that case a couple of years ago where we were checking a supplier and we ended up telling them that your certificate is worthless. And obviously they spend a lot of money on that. So that was not so nice.
After an organization is certified, what is required to maintain the certification?
That's interesting. I just published an article this morning titled with "The Certification Audit is Over. What's Next?" So once an organization gets certified, the recertification cycle begins. So in the first year after you achieve that certification, you have to undergo a surveillance audit. In the second year, you have to undergo a second surveillance audit. And then in the third year, you have to undergo another recertification audit. Now, how are they different? A certification or a recertification audit, big audits that test, evaluate, and assess the entire management system. Now, during a surveillance audit, usually an audit team will only conduct a few samples and will only evaluate parts of the management system. In the final recertification audit, the entire thing will be evaluated against. And during these 3 years, of course, you have to maintain the management system, keep everything going, conduct the internal audits, run the controls, and just do what the standard mandates you to do, basically.
Can you talk to us about best practices for internal audits? Because I think some people might spread them out throughout the year and maybe do a clause a month or something like that. Or maybe some folks would just say, okay, in the month of September, we're doing the internal audits for this year. What is your recommendation based on your experience?
As always, when it comes to auditing, you have to put your resources into perspective and you should follow a risk-based approach. So when you plan the internal audit program, you should plan the audits that target a high-risk area first, because in case they have to be canceled or rescheduled, you still have enough time to fit them in. You should also assign your resources to controls or to processes that are very important to treat risk. So always make sure to follow a risk-based approach and use your resources carefully. Now, when I plan an internal audit program, I make sure to have everything set up in the beginning of the year. So I know when is which audit and who is going to conduct it, so that I can react to sudden changes. If a security incident happened, a new risk arises, or maybe people get sick, people switch jobs, you know, you have to be adaptive.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful. Can you discuss ISO 27001 scoping approaches and why an organization might choose to reduce the scope of ISO 27001?
That's also a great question. So the scope determines for what the information security management system is applicable and for what it's not. Now, when you get certified, only your scope gets certified. That's very important to understand. Usually a scope consists of three pillars: an organizational scope, which describes probably the legal entities scope, maybe, you know, these multinational corporations to have a couple or dozens of legal entities. So it's not necessary that all of them carry a certificate afterwards. There's something like a physical scope. So you can determine if a certain building, a certain data center, an office, a room, a space is within the scope of the management system or not. And of course, you have an ICT scope, which is your information, your IT assets that process information and are therefore relevant for information security. Now, you can exclude anything from the scope as long as you can still demonstrate the overall effectiveness of securing your information. Now, why do companies or organizations decide to like limit their scope? Or why do they exclude something from their scope? From my experience, this is mostly because to save costs. The more employees are within the scope of a management system or the more physical locations there are, the more expensive these audits become. And of course, the harder it gets to actually maintain compliance. Now, coming from a security background like you do, is there any security reason why you would exclude something from an information security standpoint? Of course not. But this is where economy and business comes in. And that's where we have to find a balance, basically.
Understand. Yeah, it's very interesting because in the NIST 800-171 and CMMC world, they're data-centric security standards. And it's all about where the controlled and classified information actually resides. And so from that standpoint, you don't really have control. Well, I suppose you do have control over the scope because you could just limit where the CUI goes, hopefully. Whereas ISO is more of a system perspective, yeah. I think.
By the way, great job with your course. I had a look into it, your page and all your stuff you're doing. And I think it triggered me. So I think I want to learn more about controlled and classified information. It's very interesting.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you. Are there any ISO 27001 security controls that are required and can't be tailored out to achieve certification?
Formally, not. So in theory, you can exclude any control you want. In practice, you can't. Now, this is a very heated debate about that topic. And last year, I was able to manage to get to talk to a couple of external auditors from a big certification body here in Germany. And they basically said, of course, you can exclude any control you want, but the condition is always that the overall effectiveness of the ISMS is not infringed. So if you exclude, let's say, the control for access controls for information systems, you could do that. But will your organization still be secure? Will the ISMS deliver its intended results? No, it can't. So if you exclude these controls, you cannot be compliant with the standard. And when you reach out to a certification body, they will request you to provide them with a statement of applicability that lists the controls within scope and without of the scope. And if they see that certain controls are excluded, they will get in touch with you and they will talk things over. So don't worry, they will clear that beforehand.
Yeah, interesting. In the NIST world, we have assessment documents like NIST 800-171A, which contain assessment procedures to assess the compliance of controls. Does ISO 27001 have something similar?
Yes and no. So there is a standard, it's the 19011 standard, that describes how to audit a management system. And this standard is applicable to all management system standards. And it is further enhanced by a standard called 27007, which provides further guidelines on how to audit an information security management system. We're talking just about the clauses 4 through 10 that describe the system requirements. Now, when it comes to Annex A, where the controls are listed, the ISO 27008 standard provides assessment guidance. But I recently had a look at NIST 800-53A, which provides a ton of extensive assessment criteria. And compared to this, the ISO standard is not very good. And by the way, both like the big standards, like the 27001 and 27002, they received a makeover last year, and these standards have not been updated yet. So to be honest, they do not provide any value right now. So as of today, there is nothing like these assessment criteria.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And I think a reason for the NIST assessment procedures is to hopefully eliminate subjectivity and enhance repeatability, you know, get the same result every time. I know there's a lot of variables with different organizations and systems and all those things, but the closer we can get to having a repeatable process, I think is, you know, that's the best case. But it also goes back to the point we were raising earlier about working with an IAF affiliated certification body, because those other folks who are not, they may not have the same level of rigor when it comes to certification assessments. And as you said, a piece of paper, if it's not IAF affiliated, they have that, you know, that chain down from the accreditation body to the certification body. It may not help you, and you may be wasting your money.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's very right.
Well, this has all been so interesting. Do you have any last thoughts you'd like to add?
Yeah. So when it comes to ISO 27001, it seems to be very complicated in the beginning, but I would just advise anybody to not be too intimidated about that and just get started. If you are familiar in the security space, and this is where, now if you work in the information security space, then you know about these things. So don't get distracted by all these fancy ISO terms. Just get started and you will get the hang of it. And there's a lot of guidance out there on LinkedIn, on the web, on YouTube for free. So it's not rocket science. Just take some time and a little bit of dedication.
And I would add, take Aaron's course on ISO 27001, because that's a great resource as well. Where can people find you?
People can find me here on LinkedIn, of course. I post regularly free resources, guidance. I have a newsletter, the Learn GSC newsletter, that you can find on Substack, where I post approximately once per week a long form article about a security related topic. I have a YouTube channel that features a couple of free lessons from my courses. And of course, you can always direct message me and get in touch with
me. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it as well. And also thank you for your dedication. I know it's early where you live and we still managed to record this podcast. So shout out to you. It was a great experience and definitely eager to watch more episodes of your GSC podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.